Fan Morning Show, Sports at 590 The Fan, Blake Murphy, Justin Cuthbert, JD Bunkus, still figuring it out. Time for a second coffee there, JD.
Yeah, so we'll figure it out one of these days. You know,
one of these days.
They teach you in journalism school, never be the story, right? It's a big J journal principle. Don't be the story. And there's no bigger journalist in this country than Stephen Brunt, you know, host of the Fan Drive Time. And yet, it's like Grey Cups in Hamilton. Oh, it's all about Stephen Brunt. Soccer's in Hamilton. Beat the USA. It's all about Stephen Brunt. Now, it's like
Hamilton.
We've lost JD again there for a second. So what he was saying is... We're about to be joined by Stephen Brunt. JD's trying to say don't be the story as his tech issues dominate and become the story. But no, Stephen Brunt, our next guest, co-host of the Fan Drive Time. Stephen, are you tired of answering questions about Hamilton on the heels of Grey Cup, Canada soccer game, now the Heritage Classic? Are you ready to ditch Hamilton and talk about Newfoundland, or what's your vibe right now?
I got to tell you, Blake, I can't tell you how much I just enjoyed the last minute there when JD fell down a mineshaft is what it sounded like on my end as he was going off on that. That was so great. That's there is a God. That's what I would say. Sometimes I doubt it, but this morning there is a God. So.
Yeah, that's one for the reel. That's the highlight reel or the blooper reel or whatever.
It's great because it actually sounded like a trap door opened and he disappeared, at least on my headphones. And
there was echo, too. There was like a minor echo
as he went down into the pit. Yeah. That's so good.
I don't know if you've listened to our Wake and Rake segments at all lately, Stephen, but it wouldn't be the first time JD's been a trap door lately.
No.
He's so mad. I just made
this was
joke
supposed to be a funny joke that I made.
Yeah,
this was supposed
awesome.
To be a funny joke that I made about Brunt and not to have it turn on me. This is what happens. This is just how you know Stephen Brunt is blessed, is that even when someone tries to make fun of him, it's like some other superior force steps in and takes care of business. What's up, Brunt?
Well,
how you doing?
It should be. It's as it should be, JD. Yeah, thank you for making my morning. The coffee just kicked in. That's awesome, man. To answer your question, Blake, yes. No, I'm happy to represent my home towns. So there you go. Especially this hometown here in Ontario, which sometimes gets a bum rap, you know? It's like I was born here and grew up here. And I'm very proud to be from here.
So
it was a really nice thing. They realized that you're still not bigger than Eugene Levy, though. You've still got work to do.
Oh, yeah. I will happily take a backseat to Eugene Levy, a great Hamiltonian, McMaster grad, et cetera. Yes, that was very cool. No, it was fun. There was a little undertone in the piece. It's probably not as explicit as I would have made it if it wasn't if I was talking in the privacy of my own home. But Hamilton's been shafted by the NHL, right? Like over and over again. Like that's actually the story of hockey in Hamilton is, hang on a second, we built an arena and, you know, you kept throwing up roadblocks and you wouldn't let Jim Balsillie move teams here and we should have had the Senators in that expansion. They didn't even have any money, but the Leafs probably blocked it. So, that's our story. We're a little bitter about that whole thing here.
Does Jim Balsillie have money, though? Like,
Oh, yes.
It's like, could he?
Yes.
He's still rich?
Oh, yes.
Oh, that's good to know.
Yeah. I think he's just fine.
He's doing okay? All right. Yeah, Stewie kept him afloat for a real long time. Like, Anthony Stewart, just finally his BlackBerry was discontinued. He was devastated about it. I have one question off of that game, actually, for you before we move into Blue Jays stuff. And we did want to, you know, mostly talk to you about the Blue Jays situation this morning. But I actually asked this of Ennis, because after that winter, after a Heritage Classic game, I asked him a question that I'll just actually ask you directly. I went, how interested is Brunt in just the weirdness of this Leafs team, the up and down nature of this Leafs team, where there's all this pressure on this group? They obviously have this incredible front end talent. They're flawed in many ways, and I guess that's just kind of a nature of a salary cap, but there's always something a little bit more fun about the group. Like it reminds me a little bit of like David Price, right? Where David Price is this incredible pitcher, and we have the debate about whether being clutch is real, right? Being able to perform under pressure is real. And Ron McLean came on with us the Friday before the Heritage Classic and mentioned how he was starting to kind of buy into the Leafs' ghosts. And, you've covered sports for a while. You've seen a lot of different teams, and I am sort of just curious from your vantage point how you're looking at these guys through the lens of how we cover them, how we discuss them. It feels like even for Toronto, that overhypes everything to do with the hockey team, that this is different and that this is its own kind of beast.
Oh, yeah. I know. I'm with you. Like, look, the Leafs have lost their last game of the season every year since I was 8 years old. So, you know, and I've covered them for a good chunk of my adult life in one way or another. And, you know, there's been lots of twists and turns, but the story always ends the same way. You know, sometimes it's close but no cigars. Sometimes they're awful. You know, there has been drama, you know, certainly around the team. God, back in the Ballard years, there was drama all the time. And it was kind of toxic and horrible. But this is a new one. And they are, it's completely fascinating. You know, starting with the fact you've got a guy having the greatest season in Maple Leaf history and who may be the greatest Maple Leaf of all time. You know, and I know I've heard the poo-pooing from some folks say, oh, no, I can name six guys who are better than really?
No, come on. Yeah.
You could really name six guys who are better than him right now? Like, this for a team that has never had the best player in hockey on its roster over its long history, never once has the best player in history played for best player in the league played for the Toronto Maple Leafs. And the best player in the league is playing for the Toronto Maple Leafs right now. Like this, so let's start with that and then... Yeah, the rest of it, the roster construction, the goaltending drama, the trade deadline to come, you got to win a playoff series at least, and you look around and say, who are they going to beat? And then what happens and what's the fallout? You know, and this goes back to the Shanna plan and the tearing it down and the tanking and sometimes you build the house with but the blueprint was wrong, right? Like then something falls down. Like that's what it feels like right now.
So the Leafs are in year six of that with this core, and that obviously puts a different kind of pressure on them. The Toronto Blue Jays are still kind of in. I think they're out of it now, but last year is what, you know, Pat Riley always coins as the innocent climb. Everything feels fun. Everything feels great because you're on the way up. And then from a more economic standpoint, you know, you're on the way up before Vlads and Bos of the world get expensive. When you look at what the Blue Jays have done so far and what they're rumored to still be doing, do you sense that there's a feeling of pressure on the Blue Jays ownership group and management group to really maximize these next couple years?
Well, I don't think it's I think what they set out to do is build something that was sustainable. That you know that it wasn't a build up and tear down, or it wasn't we're backed into a corner now, we can't do anything financially. I think the idea is to try and have something that sustains and you're not going to keep every one of your guys forever. Your system has to keep producing talent and waves of talent that supplant guys who may move on and go somewhere else. Like that's the goal. So I think what I sense out of the management group now is excitement, because they have a really good core that they have, you know, and they really, you know, this is we're not that far away from a 95 loss season, but it didn't, you know, the dip did not last long. You're already in ascendance. You could have made the playoffs. Maybe you should have made the playoffs last year. You made the playoffs in the shortened season, whatever that means. But you're looking at an expanded playoff right now, and a team that, you know, even if they don't do one more thing, probably should win 95 games. But I think the interesting part for me right now is that they're acting like guys with money to spend still. That tells you something about ownership. That or the pipeline or at least the communication, the pipeline to ownership right now. Like, you know, I know people sometimes don't want to hear it, but look, these guys have come off 2 years of no revenue, like no ticket revenue, zilch. You know, I guess a little bit at the end of last season, but that was probably balanced out by the money they had to pump into the stadium in Buffalo, and yet their investment spending in this team, and willing to continue to do it. That, you know, like if you're running a ball club. That's a really good feeling. And, you know, Mark Shapiro ran a ball club in Cleveland where they never got to do that. Ever, ever, ever. So, yeah, that's what I sense is, hey, possibility. Let's go out and see who we can get. You know, if we make an offer to Freddie Freeman, will we, you know, again, I don't think you go out and talk to guys like that. I don't think you can do a lot of the stuff they've done the last 2 years unless somebody's willing to pay the tab.
Okay. I find this unbelievably fascinating. Truly, and I actually think it's the most, it's so weirdly under-discussed how ownership has seemingly changed or the narrative around ownership has changed. I know it's kind of awkward for us because we work for Sportsnet and the connection to Rogers and all this stuff. And so maybe this is a part of it, is that so many people who cover baseball don't want to come off like they're giving too much praise to Rogers, because it looks like, you know, you're almost on the take. But the last stories that we had with the Jays were what you just said, that they're losing money hand over fist because they're not playing at home and they're not getting the home revenue. There were stories about the stadium and how the company might view it as an asset, and are they going to sell the team, and what are they going to do in terms of them as a portfolio. And then we're coming into this offseason and it's, well, this is roughly what the budget's going to look like. And now they're up against what that is supposed to be. And there's rumors that they're looking at guys like Schwarber who could be $15 to $20 million. There's rumors about Freddie Freeman who would go over that number, $20+ million. Who knows what Vlad and Bo are going to get paid? They might end up trading for someone. Like, the budget seemingly looks like it is expanded despite all these other things that if you would have looked at the cookie crumbs of a year ago, you would have said it's going to go get smaller and it's going to shrink. So what is happening here? Because, or do we have any idea? Because it just seems like this is one of the – ownership matters. I'm a Seattle Seahawks fan. It's a disaster right now. It is a disaster in Seattle. Toronto Blue Jay fans, if you're looking across the landscape of baseball and what would just happen with this lockout, again, I know this just sounds like I'm trying to get moved up the corporate ladder here, but it really does seem like they're just invested in this baseball team right now financially like they've never been before.
Yeah. I can only speculate on motive, right? But in terms of the reality, that's just true, right? And again, with this, remember, with the same ownership, not, you know, within living memory, Paul Beeston was talking about payroll parameters, which was essentially, you know, if you buy more tickets, we can spend more money, but if you don't do that, we can't. Remember that there was the trade deadline. I was thinking it was the Casey Jansen trade line, because he was the guy in the clubhouse that spoke publicly. Oh, yeah. where they, you know, they had no money, they couldn't add at all, and the players were mad. There was the spring when, you know, Alex Anthopoulos had to pass the cup around to try and get players to contribute to Irvin Santana's salary if they were going to sign him because they desperately needed a pitcher.
That's
the same ownership, right? Yeah. So we're in a different place right now. It's the same company. So I don't know. Unless somebody's taken it on as a personal thing in ownership and said, this is my legacy, could be. That's a good thing. Look, ownership matters more than anything. Let's start with that.
Of course.
Like, it does. And we don't talk about it a lot of the time. We talk about GMs and presidents and coaches and stuff, but, you know, if you look at the Jays' early history, the reason they succeeded was because, you know, of the way their ownership group operated. Also because, you know, they bought a team for nothing and it was worth a ton by the time they became contenders. And then the city, we all built a lovely stadium for them. So there's a lot of good stuff going there, but very stable ownership, very supportive. They had the highest payroll in baseball in 92 and 93. So, there's sometimes it's because there's a great business case. And I think, yeah, look, there's a reasonable business case here. The Jays play to one of the biggest markets in baseball, maybe the biggest. They play to 40 million people, and it's a good baseball market. So there's money to be extracted from that market, but there's something more than that going, because, again, look at the Atlanta Braves are also owned by a publicly traded company, and Alex Anthopoulos just did a really nice bit of business on this Matt Olson trade and the extension. But, you know, the bottom line is that they wouldn't ante up for a guy who's, you know, a guy who's going to have a statue outside their stadium at some point. That's ownership. And, we are in a very different phase here, which, you know, look, I guess what it tells you is that whoever's making the call on the ownership side believes in the business plan and believes in the baseball plan.
That's great to hear.
That's the only thing I can say. Yeah, it is. It is good.
Pay to put out a good baseball team, you know, the fans will come. And hey, this is the one thing that it drives me nuts sometimes about the economics of sports, and especially something like these collective bargaining agreement negotiations we just went through, is, you know, profit, like, let's be overly reductive. Profit is revenue minus cost. There's no rule that says decreasing costs is the only way to increase profit. You could also just make more money, and a good way to do that is to be really good in a really baseball thirsty market that we have very recent precedent will respond to a winning team. So I'm thrilled to hear you say that, Stephen.
Well, you're right about that. There's evidence, right? Like 2015, 2016. Like, you know what happens when they're good. And I think until that happened, I don't think we actually knew that, you know, like it had been a long time, and been a million years since that stadium had filled up, and baseball was kind of the front burner issue in sports in Toronto. There are a lot of always baseball fans, but you know, people kind of slept through Roy Halladay's entire career. So that was kind of the experiment, right? Like, if what happens if you win? Well, here's what happens if you win, and here's what the stadium, what the attendance looks like, and here's what the TV numbers look like. So, you know, I think when Mark Spiro came in as president, he had, he came in with that happening, in the midst of that happening. And that's something you could take to ownership and say, look, here's how we're going to do it. And we're not just going to go out and, sign everybody in 2017 or 2018 and try and patch this thing over. We do have a plan organizationally. But when the moment comes, you guys need to ante up because there'll be a payoff. Now coming doing that at the end of a pandemic, that's a tough ask, man. It's a really tough ask, and I think it's quite amazing, to be honest. I wouldn't have bet on it that we are having this conversation right now.
I'm with you. Before the lockout, we were talking, hey, based on not crazy conservative estimates, but reasonable estimates, that there was maybe 15 or 20 million left in the payroll budget, and Kikuchi gets that deal that has 16 million this year, and they're still attached to guys like Freeman and Schwarber and maybe the trade market. So Stephen, you're Mark Shapiro, you go to ownership, you lay out the case that we just laid out together, and they're like, okay, spend a little bit more. Where does that money go next?
Well, I know everybody wants to talk about the extensions, for Bo and Vlad. Ben and I were talking about this with Arash on Monday night on our show. I am going to kind of pour a little cold water on that, because I think we treat those extensions as though it's just, you decide when you want to do it and then it happens. I'm not sure those are ever going to happen. They might, but the truth is it's probably more up to Bo and Vlad than it's up to the team. Like, do they want to do it? And, we've seen the Acuna deal. Like, they're not going to get the Acuna deal. Like, that's not ever happening again. Maybe, you could get the Tatis deal or something north of the Tatis deal, but I'm not even sure there. Like, I think these guys may just play it out. And so we may have to kind of wrap our heads around the fact that both those guys are going to go to free agency when they're eligible. It could happen. Is that a place you wouldn't and could spend? Sure. Absolutely, but I don't think you can bank on that unless they're willing, and I'm not sure, honestly. There's all kinds of different circumstances that dictate whether a player is going to be willing to do that. So, I think, again, if you look at what they've done so far, and it's not just the contracts, but it's the way the contracts are structured, they're trying to make sure they don't end up in a dead end where they come to a year and they have no flexibility money-wise. That they're screwed, and if somebody gets hurt or somebody ages out unexpectedly, and then you're in a tough, tough spot, and your owners are saying you can't, no more. So they've been trying to structure this so, again, it's you kind of look at every year and what their commitments are. There's a bit of a logjam next year, the last year of the Ryu deal, and they're going to have to deal with that. But again, so far, like if they're even in the dance with Freddie Freeman, and I'm not sure how much they really are. But, if you're even having that conversation, you must think there's in some world you could do it.
Yeah, boy. That actually just terrified me to my core, because my working assumption has always been, well, yeah, those guys decide when it gets done, because they're basically doing the Kirk Cousins thing where they go, we don't care. We don't need to sign this contract right now. Yep. We can just wait. And once we get there and everybody realizes that the market is most robust for us, they're going to have to give us all the money. But that the Blue Jays were just working under the don't worry, both of these guys will get paid whatever they want whenever they decide to get it. And maybe I'm realizing, based on your answer, that might be a little presumptuous.
Well, I think it's eyes wide open on both sides. Like, mm-hmm. I don't think the Jays are under any illusions here. I think they'll have that conversation, and if it's doable, they'll do it. But I don't think anybody should assume that, because, it's, again, it takes two, right? It takes both sides. And, look, the truth is, neither of those guys come from, from need, a position of need, right? They both grew up the sons of major league ball players pretty comfortably. That's not the different circumstances than a lot of other ball players. So, I get the sense, especially with Bo, you know, that he's very savvy about the baseball business. Mm-hmm. And he's going to try and get to extract as much value as he possibly can, and he should. You know, it's his career. It's his life. So, but that's not the end of the world. Like, that's the other thing. You know, yeah, I would love those guys to, you know, retire as Blue Jays and then go straight into the Hall of Fame, and then we can put the statues up. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't happen very often.
Well, it's also just it makes you appreciate even more what's happening right now. And just mm-hmm. say, this is a live-in-the-moment type of situation where you go, look at this Blue Jays team. They've got ownership that's backing the money in this unprecedented way. They've got unprecedented young talent and a rotation that can rival just about anybody. A pretty savvy front office. Like, there's a lot of things that are working in your favor as a Blue Jays fan. So looking forward, this might not be the time. But that, so if it is this moment, if we're trying to crystallize this, if you're trying to capitalize on the bird in hand with having those two players on these deals, it leads you to believe that, okay, well, if we're talking legacy and tying all this stuff together, it's, well, you got to do it now then. You have to make this move now. There is more pressure. And it seems like they're not in on Freeman. Maybe they end up surprising everybody. The Schwarber number looks pretty big. They're still the front runner, but it looks like it's going to come in somewhere between 15, 20 million bucks a year for that guy. Where do they go with the infield then? Because Atkins mentioned it, that it's still the priority of this team. Doesn't feel like you can go on the cheap here. Feels like you got to actually still make, like, even if they get Schwarber, it still feels like a splashy move has to come on the in the infield.
Maybe, you know, or maybe it has to come in July. I don't, like, look, I honestly, I think you could feel the team they had. I think you could feel the team they have right now with Santiago Espinal and Kevin Biggio as opening day starters, and you're still a really good team because of the pitching. I think you're still a really good team. So you don't, yeah, I dream on Jose Ramirez just like everybody else does, or Ketel Marte or somebody, and that could still happen. But, you know, you don't have to have an all-star at every position necessarily. You know, they're going to score runs, and I say the pitching is going to be really important this year with the way the schedule is going to run. And on paper, that's the best rotation they've had. I'm not going to say ever, but you know, maybe close to ever. You don't know totally what you're going to get out of Ryu, but the other guys are kind of prime time. You could do that. Like, again, the other thing is, and again, this is, it's worth talking about, they've still got a ton of prospect capital. They've been solving problems with money or adding with money, which doesn't cost you anything other than money. They haven't dipped into their prospect capital at all. And that's, you know, again, if you listen to what these guys said when they came in to start running the team, they talked about, you know, it's not just one guy. It's not just Vladdy or a Bo or one guy coming. You need guys coming every year, not just to supplant other people on the roster, but to trade. And so, you know, Gabe Moreno's got a lot of value right now, it would appear. You know, or Elvis Martinez has a lot of value right now. And then there's guys, you know, you want guys coming behind them. So they haven't even dipped into that yet. And, you know, again, from a fan point of view, you would rather they just solved it with money and that you kept all the goodies, you know, because that gives you some options, you know, in the near term and the long term. But eventually they're going to do it, right? And so maybe it's, you know, it's not a free agent conversation, it's a trade conversation. But I don't think it has to happen by opening day necessarily. I think there's, you know, you got some breathing room here, I think.
That's what I brought up with Jeff Blair the other day on our show as well, is just, yeah, you want to, ideally you enter the season with the team the way it's going to be, but coming off of 2 years of shortened and abbreviated and maybe even low scouting minor league seasons, maybe you need a little bit of time to convince another team that your 3, 4, 5, 6 guys in the system are worth a Jose Ramirez or a Matt Chapman. Stephen Brunt, thanks so much for talking us through some of this. Agree that the Jays are in a good spot regardless. Would love for them to be in a great spot, though. Thanks so much for taking the time this morning.
All right. See you guys.
Stephen Brunt, co-host of the Fan Drive Time Show with our pal Ben Ennis. And that brings us to something to chew on, brought to you by Great Canadian Meats.
Yum, yum, yum.
So Stephen Brunt made the point, and Stephen Brunt is always right, so this is, of course, accurate statistically, even though he didn't use numbers, that the Blue Jays will be good as currently constructed. I ran a little lineup optimizer tool this morning based on the Jays' current roster, and this is using Fangraph Zips projections. They would be, their optimized lineup would be expected to score 5.29 runs in a game. That's not going to happen over the course of a whole season. That's what your one game best lineup on an average is going to score. That is actually higher than the Jays offense last year, which averaged 5.22. It's almost as high as the Astros' best offense in baseball. However, remember the other day when I was saying there are no diminishing returns to the lineup? You add Kyle Schwarber in there, filling the Randall Grichuk spot in my little optimizer, the Jays score more than a quarter of a run extra. You add Matt Chapman for Santiago Espinal on top of that, and you're getting another eighth of a run. So these things add up quickly, and you're taking what's a good offense and turning it into a great offense with even one of these additions still. So it's Stephen Brunt is absolutely correct that you could enter the season right now very confident in your team with your starting rotation, with the depth of options you have in the bullpen, even if you don't have an established kind of 7-8-9 hierarchy, and with your lineup. But things are going to look a lot cooler if you add even one more bat, whether it's an infield, whether it's a left side of the plate. So something to chew on there is that there's this team goes from a good offense to a great offense really quickly with one more addition.
There's no debating that, right? That's no. That to me is this is
no. I ran the lineup tool. Oh, so
100%. And I listen when the lineup tool tells you that the Blue Jays lineup is good. I go, that's a good lineup tool because the Blue Jays lineup is good. It's a quality tool. They're gonna add a lefty bat. It's going to happen. I sort of wondered, by the way, if they might have missed. The Mariners made a sneaky, really good trade. They basically just pilfered from a team, and they added a couple things that the Blue Jays could have used. And I was looking at that as a Toronto must feel fairly confident that they're going to hit in free agency, because the move that got made by Seattle where they get Winker is
and Suarez.
Yeah, exactly. Both those guys. And Suarez is a diminished asset and maybe a bigger contract, but he's like
it's
a
just
huge
a
bounce
money
back candidate.
Eat. Yeah,
exactly. It's a money eat thing, and it that would have filled both of Toronto's needs. And I thought, man, for you to lose out on that, considering Seattle did not give up a lot of prospects, that was mostly a eating the Suarez money deal. From a baseball standpoint, people have looked at that around the league and said, that is a great move for Seattle. That's a big boy move for Seattle. Toronto could have addressed those needs with that trade. They could have jumped in the mix on that trade. They didn't do it. I have to believe, anyways, that is in part because they prefer a different route and they feel very confident in the route that they're taking. So, yeah, go out and get Schwarber, pay him whatever, and go into the season without necessarily addressing your infield. I'm with you in Brunt that it is okay. I guess where I get a little skeptical or I get a little nervous is the potential opportunity cost of someone else getting in and making that Mariners deal, where you go, hey, Ramirez actually did become available and someone else swooped in there and they found out that they're pretty good and now they're in a playoff mix and now they feel a little bit more emboldened to trade something to get in on those sweepstakes. Same thing goes for Chapman, right? Where, okay, right now what you know about the Blue Jays is that they have the better prospects. Like the thing you just said, Blake, about how maybe you need more time to get information about those prospects.
Yeah, you do need a little bit more time, and sorry to cut you off there, JD. You're just digitizing on us a little bit there. Yeah, you do need a little bit more time, and you do have that depth of system. There are going to be opportunities, but like you said, those opportunities are not infinite. The season's going to start, and the Jays are going to want to see what they have with guys, or teams are going to, you know, one of these teams maybe overperforms, and suddenly a Cleveland team isn't really willing to sell Jose Ramirez because, you know, they've overperformed, or you know, the Cincinnati Reds are absolutely not going to do this, but maybe they decide to not move off one of their pitchers because things are clicking and you can't just absorb Joey Votto's money. So Suarez is an interesting one where the Reds are obviously selling to unload money. And he's a 30 homer guy who has an average below 200 last year. But you get Winker in that deal and you give up 26-year-old prospects to get it done. So, yeah. That's a like I don't think anyone like Jake Fraley's a fourth outfielder type. Justin Dunn is you know, fifth starter slash wingman type. Maybe there's some upside there. But
if the Jays make that trade, it's a hugely celebrated, massive move in the city. Listen, I pay attention to Seattle sports. I know how this is being interpreted by people around baseball. I followed it closely. It's a coup. Everyone's this trade is genuinely getting talked about. Like, how did this happen? How did Seattle get this trade? Because it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, it's like Palacios, Thornton, and a prospect. Yeah.
Yep, it's outrageous that they got those guys. So that's all. I'm just saying the opportunity cost of potentially letting other teams in the mix, finding out that your prospects aren't as good as what you thought they might be, and other teams finding out that information too, those things could be damaging. What happens if Groshans is not a stud and Pearson doesn't have a good start to his year, right? Then you're forced to go up into the Orelvis Martinez category, right? With prospects, if you're going to make the Ramirez move, maybe you're forced to even go there for a Chapman type because now you feel as though that's the only outlet that you have. It just, the idea that only works one way feels like how it's been sort of portrayed is you don't need to make this move because you have all the prospects and you have all the leverage and blah, blah, blah. And I just think that we need to acknowledge that those things can change and they can go against you. Maybe that's obvious. Maybe that's not anything profound. But it's sort of how I felt about why I'm a little bit more urgent in terms of trying to go and take care of that position now. Is I don't want to have it turn into something that people will end up regretting.
Yeah, it's the showcase thing, right? Like maybe you call up Nick Robertson and yeah, he looks good and teams are interested in him, or maybe you call him up and he looks like a guy who's not ready and can't play on the second line. So that's all a little something to chew on. We're gonna take a break. Maybe we'll chew on some NBA stuff coming out of the break, but we got to talk about Baker Mayfield saying a goodbye before he's gone. That's next on the Fan Morning Show, Sports at 590 The Fan.
Breaking down the biggest stories in Toronto sport. The Fan Morning Show with JD, Blake, and Ailish. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Fan Morning Show, Sports at 590, The Fan. Blake Murphy, JD Bunkus, Justin Cuthbert. Give us all a follow on your socials, at JC Cuthbert on Twitter. I'm Blake Murphy, ODC. And if you followed JD Bunkus at JD Bunkus, you would have seen him just tweet out a screen cap of Carlos Baerga reporting on his Instagram, without flame emojis, mind you, that he is told by sources that the Jays are close to acquiring Matt Chapman from the Oakland Athletics. Carlos Baerga is on with us a little bit later in the show, so stick around for that. But it's shaping up to be potentially quite an exciting day for the Toronto Blue Jays. We have talked about Matt Chapman over the course of the week, of course. Gold Glove caliber third baseman. A right-handed hitter, sure, but when you can add another league average to plus hitter who's also an elite defender, again, it's no questions asked, you make that Matt Chapman addition also controllable for this year and next through the ARB system. JD, I know we don't know a price, we don't know if this is official or anything yet, but your initial thoughts on Carlos Baerga's report, other than why'd you post it on Instagram instead of saying it live with us?
Well, my initial thought is he's arguably the best defensive third baseman in baseball, and that's going to be really, really fun with the hot corner. It also tells me that if you're adding him, you're feeling more confident in adding Schwarber. So yeah, it's a two-parter where you go, he doesn't fit the profile of what this team was necessarily looking for, but great defense, so plus defense, no more discussions around moving Vladdy to third. Hey, Vladdy, if Matt Chapman's coming to town, no more taking ground balls at third during spring because you're never going to play there. That guy's going to play there just about every single day. I also wonder what it means for the future of a guy like Espinal, whether or not they are going to keep him. Because if you have Chapman in there, that's a lot of games that you're absorbing for that third baseman. I think about the last time these two teams made that big trade with Josh Donaldson, and you went out and got a third baseman. I wouldn't say that Chapman's that. The OPS was quite down last year. You know, it was like around 700. But he's still a guy who I think profiles really well with this team. Obviously still an above-average third baseman, an elite glove, a solid quality bat, and someone who's probably a bit of a bounce back candidate and isn't going to cost you. I guess the prospects will kind of dictate to a degree how I feel about this trade, because I'd have to feel like you were getting a pretty good deal considering what just happened with the Matt Olson trade and the fact that Jose Ramirez at some point is not likely to continue his career with the Cleveland Guardians, whether that's in season or during the off season. I don't know. I'm very excited for this, but this to me is more of a defense play than an offense play.
Yeah, and Chapman's not a bad offensive player. He's been a league average or better hitter in all five of his major league seasons. But what you're looking at with him, at least the last two seasons, is a lower OBP guy who is going to put the ball in the air and is going to hit some home runs. So very much within the mold of what the Jays' type is at the dish. But we've talked about, and they've talked about, wanting a little bit of stylistic versatility at the dish. He's not that. He's more of the good right-handed hitting, can draw a walk, but maybe isn't a super high contact type. You know, almost profiles like a souped-up Randall Grichuk in that regard, or Randall Grichuk who will take a walk on occasion. But yeah, some even factoring in some poor luck on balls in play the last couple years, he only projects to be about a 230 hitter, but he projects to be a 230 hitter with a double-digit walk rate and close to 30 home runs. So you can see easily where that slides in as your maybe your number six hitter, and that makes the back end of the heart of your order fairly dangerous.
Listen, he was an MVP candidate and an All-Star in 2019. You get that
version. He's worth almost 14 wins over 2018 and 2019.
Yeah, you get that version, and it's a unbelievable hit. If you get the version that Oakland got last year, then it's a little I don't want to say underwhelming, but it's not as splashy as maybe you would think, just based on the name alone.
We don't know his salary yet because he's part of the ARB system, but like you're talking 9 or 10 million based on most ARB estimates. For last year was a down year by his standards, and he was still worth 3.4 wins based on FanGraphs metrics. So even allowing for some inaccuracy there, that those things aren't exact, you're paying about $10 million for, say, three wins on the downside of Matt Chapman. That's still good value depending on what the prospect haul is here.
And it's not in the slightest bit disruptive, right? Like, it's the opposite of disruptive. It's putting yourself in the position where you achieve more stability. And I think that is important. Like, we're video gaming it, fantasizing about the possibility of Freddie Freeman. But to disrupt what is already such an impressive core by shifting lineups around, I don't know, shoehorning that didn't really make that much sense. And now I think you can get as aggressive as possible with that lefty slugger, which of course is Kyle Schwarber. And we just talked to Steven Brun, who suggested they're sitting on a pile of money they're ready to spend. So Schwarber makes all the sense of the world to accompany that move or potential move.
So I would say, though, if they're adding Chapman for prospect capital and then they also intend to add Schwarber as a left-handed bat, I do wonder, and I've wondered this a couple times out loud over the last couple weeks, if they have a Grichuk move lined up, because that is, you know, potentially 25, 30 million extra salary if you're getting a Chapman and a Kyle Schwarber based on the estimates that are out there, you know, and if you get Schwarber, Grichuk is really crunched for playing time, right? He's a little bit redundant at the plate. He's probably your best defensive outfielder, but you're clearly like you're getting Kyle Schwarber and you're committing to George Springer in center a lot. You're obviously not that concerned about it. I would be curious if, hey, and maybe Grichuk is going back in a Chapman deal and there's extra prospect capital to balance out the money. Yeah. Who knows? But that's the domino I would look to fall if Chapman and Schwarber are both a legitimate option.
I'd be surprised if the Oakland A's, the world's cheapest team, did a deal that took money back in order to take in prospects. It would be, again, hard for me to envision that one. My fear with the Grichuk domino, you're right, Blake. It seems like that's there. And Grichuk's a guy who I've talked to about this. I've talked to Randall Grichuk about this. He likes playing every day. He does not like being a bench player. He feels as though he should play every day, and he likes being a center fielder too. I'll tell you that. He likes being in center field. He likes having an everyday role. And it doesn't feel like he'll ever have that here unless there's an injury to Springer. The only reason that I would say still having Grichuk is a luxury or a nice thing is because of the Springer question mark. It depends on how you feel about Springer. They would say they feel good about having Springer and that, man, if you're investing the George Springer contract and then also having to pay for Grichuk as insurance, that's a lot. That's adding money to the Springer deal that's already a lucrative free agent contract. But there is, I would say, all of a sudden you do need to figure out at least one other bench outfield option, right? Because Lourdes Gurriel Jr., Kyle Schwarber, I know we're putting Kyle Schwarber down in pen here. We shouldn't be maybe getting that excited about this. But Teoscar Hernandez, that's not a lot of plus defensive players, especially since some people think that George Springer is not going to age into being the best center fielder and that he could end up being someone who needs to occupy a corner outfield spot. I kind of am curious how the Blue Jays would approach that. If they view that as, we need to get this money off the books, or, you know what, actually, even if we do add this bat, we've got to have at least some insurance here defensively that we can give a different look, we can give a different complexion. I'm guessing that they would say, though, we can get defense in the minors. We can get defense.
Well, that's the thing, and the name to watch there, would, unless he's outbound in this trade, would maybe be Josh Palacios, who we can ask Carlos Baerga about. We're going to have Carlos on at 8 a.m. now. So after this next break, we can ask him because I believe that they have a relationship. But Palacios, 26 years old, left-handed bat, plays all three outfield positions. Not a, world beater at the dish, but we also haven't seen him for any real samples since, 2019 because the way the minor leagues have worked. And prior to that, he was a slightly to moderately above-average bat for his age and for his level. Obviously, at that stage, a 26-year-old prospect, you're bringing him in because he's a guy who could be a lefty bat and play the outfield and doesn't need everyday touches. That's kind of the draw of a guy like that. But there might be something there with Palacios as a fourth outfielder type, or even fifth if you consider Schwarber a real option in the field.
I will say that if this does happen, if Baerga is correct, and some people are tweeting at me how, oh, Baerga said Freddie Freeman. He said Freddie Freeman. To be fair, he did say 70% Freddie Freeman. He put a percentage on it that the Blue Jays were in on him, that he liked their chances. He never said it's done. This one is a little different. This is a pretty, unless something is lost in translation here, this is sources assure us the team now has the best third base in the MLB on their roster. They just managed to get Matt Chapman. That's the language, right? They managed to get Matt Chapman, implying that it is already done. To me, I'm a big Matt Chapman fan. I really am. He is just one of those guys that makes slick plays at third on a essentially nightly basis. He can draw a walk. I don't think that the offensive numbers last year were an indicator of, I think that's a low, and especially in this lineup. He does profile.
Well, it is. I mean, it's the low for his career, right? Yep. Even his partial rookie season, he hit a little better than that. And who knows? Maybe there's a component of he sold out for the home run power a little bit too much. Yep. I'd have to dig into his splits a little bit more. But it seemed like partially a bad luck on ball and play season. And, the strikeout rate was actually down from 2020, which is maybe encouraging in terms of contact profile moving forward. But again, you're not bringing in Matt Chapman. He's not the Freeman Schwarber ad where you're looking at him as second or third in your lineup. He's a guy who's bringing plus-plus defense, and if he's your six or seven hitter, you're over the moon.
Yes, absolutely you are. And that's the beauty of adding a guy like Chapman is on this roster, it is a pretty damn good fit. This is just about as perfect a fit as you can get. But where I was going with this is, I got to admit, and I will get over it, but I was so high on the idea for Jose Ramirez, and it was such a thing where they went down that path last year. They at least discussed it. That part of this trade, weirdly, is always to me going to be measured against whatever happens with Jose Ramirez. It's just that's for me personally, and I think for a lot of Blue Jays fans, because Jose Ramirez's name was linked to the Blue Jays last year at the deadline. He was linked to them this year. We talked about him with Morosi. Everyone has said, hey, this is such a perfect trade candidate. The Jays have the front office that came over from Cleveland. They know Jose Ramirez. Cleveland needs to shed the money. They're not going to end up re-signing this guy to a deal. Look, Cleveland doesn't give people big money contracts, so they needed to return prospects. The Blue Jays are unbelievably rich in prospect capital. All of these different things look like they line up perfectly for a trade. I wonder if it just came down to, they wouldn't budge on the Aralvis Martinez, Gabe Moreno thing. And the Blue Jays went, we think these guys are superstars. These guys are, to go back to that Brunt conversation we just had, insurance if we lose one of these two guys to have another star that's, we want to keep winning. We want to have waves of winning. We're not willing to do that. We feel like Matt Chapman doesn't downgrade us that much. But we do feel like the prospect price is. Again, the prospect price here has to be wildly different than what it would have been for Jose Ramirez.
Yeah, and the other thing to consider, too, is that the Guardians are not quite the level of A's in terms of cheapness. They were decent last year. Fangraphs projects them to be a 78-win team. And Ramirez has another year after this year. So if you're Cleveland and you're worried about Ramirez eventually leaving for free, you have kind of an 18-month runway here to wait. And if you want to get a longer look at prospects, or you want to wait until someone's desperate at the trade deadline, Jeff Blair said yesterday, and you just kind of echoed it, that it's made so much sense for so long that the fact that it hasn't happened yet is like, okay, well, what's the hitch we're missing? What is the thing we're not getting here, or what is the sticking point? And that might be that the Guardians are not as eager to trade him as we've all assumed from outside, because he is such a good fit so many places. Like, keep in mind, too, you fire up Jose Ramirez's MLB trade rumors page, there's not a lot. There hasn't been a ton of Ramirez chatter outside of he would make a lot of sense for many good teams because he's very good and affordable.
It's not just perception, right? Like, the Jays do have the strong prospect system. Like, they have the strong prospect capital. But I feel like there's something to cashing in on that, right? That you have such a bloated system where you have these players that you can, or these prospects that you can use as currency. Like, prospects can be fleeting. Like, you mentioned the danger of waiting, JD. Like, it may not last. It may not be beyond those big two guys that this is such a dominant system. We don't know what Pearson's going to be like. We don't know how these other guys are going to perform. And right now, perception is that it's an all-time high. And I guess you are dealing from that to get Chapman, if they indeed did get Chapman. But I feel like there's an element to cashing in while you can that, you know, the Jays might miss on here.
What I will say, though, is that Moreno and Martinez, like, those two guys are a different category of this, is that you don't miss as frequently in baseball as you used to, right? The development systems have gotten better. This is across all sports, right? If there are can't-miss, quote-unquote, guys, the hit rate, I'm guessing, in this day and age, in 2022 versus 1998, is wildly different based on all of the data information that we have. It's a different sport in terms of evaluation. It really does feel like those two guys are closer to the can't miss tier. And so I could understand them saying, we're not willing to give that up, or we're less willing to give that up in a package that includes three or four other things, including, you know, the Lourdes Gurriel Jr., Alejandro Kirk types. That's the other part of this deal. Like, again, maybe I would say that there's at least a chance, if this trade happens, that Lourdes goes out the door. Would you say that that's at least a possibility, Blake? I don't know. Maybe.
And that's where, you know, you look at, again, to go back to that Winker and Suarez deal, where Jake Fraley's a guy who is far enough along developmentally that he can slot in, right? Because another thing that you have to keep in mind with young teams and teams that are rebuilding or trying to get cheap is they need guys who can play right now without burning the service time of their prospects who are a little further away. And Lourdes is a... If I'm a team like Cincinnati or Oakland or Cleveland, I'm looking at him as a guy who can inexpensively fill in at a couple different positions if you need, but primarily in the outfield. He's also a guy who we know he's good vibes, but he's also a guy who potentially a plus asset flip. You drop him into an everyday role, he hits as well as he does during that one big hot stretch he had last year, and suddenly he's a guy you can turn around and move again at the deadline, maybe. So if I'm an Oakland or a Cleveland or a Cincinnati, he's a guy I'm really interested in as a piece,
of course,
versus eating Grichik's money or taking on a less proven guy like a Palacios.
I would just say that my hope is, in a trade like this, that the upside is that you don't need to trade Lourdes, that you are that they are more inclined to take prospects, guys that are a little further away, and that opposed to the Cleveland Guardians deal, maybe they would have wanted guys like, hey, we want to have Kirk in this deal. We want to have Lourdes in this deal, and we want Aurelvis Martinez in this deal. We want a Nate Pearson. You start stacking names on it, you go, well, now we're robbing from this roster. We're robbing from our future. We're robbing from our starting pitching depth. There's just the good thing about, hopefully anyways, this Chapman deal. Oh, do we have it?
John Morosi also reporting that Matt Chapman to Toronto is under discussion, he says.
Under discussion.
He says Carlos Baerga is reporting that the trade is agreed upon, as we laid out, and as we'll talk to Baerga about after this break. But John Morosi confirming that it's in discussion, at least.